Hi, I'm John Wolfstall, host of We're All Gonna Die Radio here on the Deep State Radio Network. If you're interested in the intersection of cutting-edge technologies, national security, and the things that may just kill us all, then please give our show a listen every Friday. Members of the Deep State Radio Network gain access to exclusive content, access to the DSR Slack and Discord communities, expanded show notes for select episodes, and more. All of this for just $7 a month or $70 a year. As a thanks for listening, I'm offering a 25% discount off the regular membership price. Please visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code cyber. That's thedsrnetwork.com/BUY and code cyber. Thank you, and thanks for listening.
Nine, 12, 10, 28, 2, 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Welcome to another episode of We're All Gonna Die Radio. It is the start of the baseball season, which is very, very exciting for the show in particular. I am one of your co-hosts, Heather Williams, and I am joined by shameless Yankees fan, John Wolfstall. Hi, John. How's it going?
I'm good, Heather. When you have a lot of World Series rings, you can afford to be shameless. So I'm feeling pretty good.
Yeah, well, I was gonna start the trash talking now, but I don't think this is our season. I'm just gonna go ahead and say it after the first game.
It's okay. We all live in the shadow of other teams, and that's okay, Heather.
Oof, you're right. You do live in the shadow of the Red Sox. So for today's episode, we're pivoting. Let's say that we're pivoting. We initially planned to have a conversation, which I was really excited about, with Bob Carlin, who wrote a really important an interesting and thought-provoking and exciting piece about North Korea and North Korea's interest in escalation and North Korea's nuclear program. Unfortunately, the technology didn't cooperate with us today, but watch this space. Check back in the next few weeks, and we will be having that conversation and hearing from Bob. But in the meantime, John and I, we have thoughts. We have feelings about the state of the nuclear world. And today genuinely does feel like a good time to kind of take a beat and take a look at what's going on in the nuclear landscape. There's a lot going on out there. So I have some thoughts and feelings about DPRK that I want to get to at some point. But John, what is the nuclear or non-nuclear risk that you think is most likely to cause us all to die in the near future that you want to talk about?
Heather, why so dark? I mean, you know, opening day is about hope. Hope springs eternal, although the headline for the Washington Nats was Hope Springs a Leak. So maybe that should be the new catchphrase for We're All Gonna Die Radio. You know, I had a really interesting conversation with a friend this week. We routinely would get asked during the 90s and 2000s, like if there was a nuclear war that was going to start today, where would you, you know, be concerned? And it was almost always Pakistan, right? It was almost always the risk that, you know, India, Pakistan, tensions would bubble over, or that collapse in Pakistan would lead to it. Of course, that threat hasn't gone away, and both India and Pakistan continue to build nuclear weapons eagerly. I think we continue to face a challenge that people are becoming numb to in Ukraine. And the prospect of an active war zone tipping the balance through miscalculation. The big news this week was that a Russian missile overflew Poland and then redirected itself. Why and how, I think, remains to be seen. But, you know, war is not a clean, clinical effort where everybody controls every aspect. It's chaos. And so, you know, the risk that can spiral out of control quickly remains pretty heavily in my view. But
just quickly on that, John, I did see that Poland put out a statement saying that in the future they might take steps to shoot down Russian missiles before they crossed into Polish airspace to try to prevent that from happening more in the future. And I mean, that sounds to me like a recipe for crisis escalation if I ever heard one. I don't know if that's going to go anywhere, but what did you think of that?
Well, I mean, okay, let's dive right into it for the hardcore deterrence geeks, right? I mean, one of the things about the Cold War is that the United States and the Soviet Union were separated by about 5,000-7,000 miles, at least over the Atlantic theater of operations. And we had the luxury of time. We could see things coming at us. They could see things coming at them. And so we had at least a little bit of time to take a breath. When you have an active conflict with NATO border on Russia border, you don't have that luxury. And Russia has talked about increasingly the need to launch on warning. The United States and NATO occasionally talk about preemption and these questions about left of launch. And this, of course, is the real problem. How do we find a balance between deterrence and defense capabilities that are not at the same time provocative and that lead the other side to have to worry about preemption? And that's true in the nuclear world. It's true in the conventional world. And if I were Poland, I would want to make sure that we could shoot down missiles over my territory. And if it happens routinely, it's understandable that they're going to start thinking about being more proactive. So this is just the world that we're in. It's another reason the war in Ukraine matters to the United States and why we need to give it the attention it deserves.
Yeah, I've been in a lot of conversations about NATO recently, and there seems to be a growing kind of theme to the discussions, which is Russia is intentionally manipulating risk in Ukraine. And, you know, Russia perceives that the U.S. and our NATO allies have a lower risk tolerance than they do because they have higher stakes in Ukraine. They may or may not be wrong about that. But as in a lot of these conversations, I started to criticize Russia's risk manipulation because it does seem particularly dangerous and escalatory and inhumane to me in a lot of ways. At the same time, deterrence is risk manipulation, like by definition. That is what we are talking about, whether it's conventional or nuclear weapons. We are also trying to manipulate the risk for Russia. I think the difference here is that Russia does seem much more willing to violate sovereign borders, commit human rights abuses, and try to really bully not just the Ukrainians, but also NATO members into just conceding large swaths of sovereign country to them. So, but it's really hard to say, oh, well, this is good risk manipulation and this is bad risk manipulation. So it's really prompted, I think, an important discussion about the nature of deterrence.
Well, Heather, look, you're the PhD and the pseudo academic. You're a practitioner, but you have
recovering. I'm a recovering academic.
I like that. But, you know, this gets into the larger questions about Russia is a non-status quo power, right? We, the United States and NATO, have more to lose because we are rich and prosperous and secure. Russia wants to achieve its aims by putting that at risk because it has less to lose, or at least wants to project that. But in the end, escalation is all about trying to project a willingness or a commitment to take on risk that the other side is not. And the United States and Russia both today believe that they can control escalation. They care more than the other. And that, of course, is one of the reasons people worry about escalation getting out of control. And it's true in nuclear, it's true in conventional, and it's true in the stakes in Ukraine. And, you know, Russia's also doing everything it can to influence the perception that the United States does and doesn't care about Ukraine. And that's where the internal politics here in the United States gets iffy.
Well, you know, John, 2 weeks ago, we had Mike Kaufman on the podcast to talk about risks of nuclear use in Ukraine. And one issue that Mike and I think disagreed about was what might raise the costs for Russia of escalation or nuclear use. And I was exploring the possibility that Putin might care about what Xi or Modi or maybe some other actors in the international community think. You know, Russia does remain dependent on external actors, at least for weapons at this point, in addition to some, they need people to buy their energy resources. And Putin, I would assume, is very aware of that. And Mike pushed back on that pretty hard and said, no, if Vladimir Putin is losing and nuclear weapons, if he believes that nuclear weapons could help him win, nothing would stop him from doing that. I'm paraphrasing, and our listeners should go back and check out that episode and listen to it again. But since you weren't able to join for that one, John, I wanted to put that question to you. Do you think that international opinion can raise the cost sufficiently for Vladimir Putin to deter him from escalating in Ukraine.
So, Heather, as you know, you and I have talked about this offline, particularly after the really well-researched and detailed report that you and your colleagues put out at CSIS earlier this year. But I do think this argument that Putin has been and could be swayed by Xi or Modi or other international leaders is overplayed. Neither you or I work for the U.S. government, and so we're speaking as outside analysts. But the argument that in 2022, when things were not looking so great for Russia and Ukraine seemed to be on the offensive, and the risks of nuclear use went up, and then they went down, did coincide with both Modi and Xi saying, we don't think nuclear war should be on the table. But it also coincided with the Ukrainian counteroffensive faltering and Russia stabilizing its defensive lines. And so I think we have to be very cautious about trying to put direct causation on any one particular piece. And it gets to this larger problem, which is we've been at the game of bilateral nuclear deterrence for 68, 70 years, and we're not very good at it. And we shouldn't have too much confidence that we really understand what Putin thinks and is signaling. And we shouldn't have confidence that he really understands where our red lines are, because this is about leaving the threat of use to chance, to ambiguity. That's part of the play here, but I think it's beyond our ability to firmly estimate. So I worry more about it. I think I'm with Mike. I don't like to argue with you unless it's over something important like baseball, but I think on this one, we may not agree.
You're totally right. We're not going to know. Nobody can really know what goes on in Vladimir Putin's head. I don't imagine that it is a nice place inside his head.
Yeah, you know, there are probably lots of like black velvet portraits of Siberian tigers and, you know, him riding shirtless through the hinterlands. How's that for a nice image you can sort of...
I bet there's a really, really big portrait of Stalin inside of his head. And,
oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
the
I'm talking about there's a big portrait of Stalin in the Kremlin, true.
So. Yeah.
Speaking of dark, scary places, we were going to talk about North Korea today, but I think it's worth talking a little bit about that because there was some, I think, interesting news that links geostrategy to nuclear geekery. So... there has been for many years, a couple of decades actually, a UN Security Council resolution which imposes sanctions on North Korea. And there's been an experts committee that's been involved in tracking those sanctions and ensuring that they're implemented well and effectively and reported. Russia killed that body today or this week. And a lot of people are speculating that this is part of the price that Kim Jong-un asked for when Russia came to them and said, hey, we need a bunch of missiles and artillery shells. Heather, do you want to talk people through whether you think that's significant and what may be at work here?
So I think it's significant. I think we should be asking why Russia did this. And since reading the news, I've come up with three possible explanations that are not mutually exclusive and could be overlapping. So what Russia did was, canceled these UN inspections of North Korea's nuclear program. So scenario one is that maybe there is something going on in North Korea's nuclear program that Russia doesn't want people to see. Could this be some sort of deeper collaboration on nuclear issues between Putin and Kim than has come to light? There's been a lot of stories lately about closer ties between the two of them. And so maybe there's something specifically in the nuclear side of things that Russia just doesn't want to get detected, and there or something that might be coming down the pipeline that they plan to do that they don't want to get detected. So that's option one. Option two, I think, is that this is a favor that Russia is doing to North Korea for North Korea's supply of various weapon systems to Russia for its war in Ukraine. And this is kind of just a gentleman's agreement, though neither of them I would describe as gentlemen, to help each other out in the international system and wink, wink, nod, nod, get on with the day. That's what I think is most likely, to be clear. That makes the most sense to me and gels. Option three could be that Russia is just doing this as part of a either coordinated or uncoordinated strategy to undermine the few remaining arms control and nuclear security efforts that are still in play in the international system. Russia has consistently cheated on arms control treaties, just a few months, just 1 month ago, there are these new concerns that Russia might be violating the Outer Space Treaty. And I asked some folks around the office here to put together a list of what are arms control agreements or, you know, verification, confidence building measures that are still in place that Russia has not in some way soiled. And it's a really short list that includes...
They put it on the back of a calling card, right? They didn't actually put it.
I think we came up with five. And this includes things like the Seabed Treaty and the Antarctic Treaty. Though I've also been reading reports that Russia's increasingly interested in Antarctica. So who knows what could be next?
But give them time. They're working alphabetically through the treaty.
So I think the option three is that Russia is just doing this out of a desire to, you know, it's like that quote from, I don't remember. I think it was The Dark Knight. Some people just want to see the world burn. Russia just might want to see the international order burn.
And you know, we love movie quotes here, Heather, on We're All Going to Die, because, so that works for me. I'll give you a fourth reason I just thought of, which is it was also this week that Russia and China vetoed a U.S. Proposed resolution on a ceasefire in Gaza. And the explanation for that is because the United States had vetoed previous resolutions. And so there may also just be a U.N.-centric effort here that whatever the U.S. supports, Russia is going to oppose. Because I don't know how much guidance the UN ambassador is getting all the way back from Moscow. Putin's probably busy, dreaming up more war crimes for Crimea and the Donbass. We've always had concerns that there isn't as strong a coordination inside Russia as there is in other countries. But I think all four worry me. And I think it also signals to a larger problem, which you and I have talked about a lot, which is, you know, look, we benefit from having some norms and rules of the road that help with stability and predictability. People who support arms control do that for many reasons. But one of the main reasons is it allows us to operate with a little bit of confidence in a world where you don't have perfect knowledge and you can't always rely on your satellites or your spies to give you a sense on what's going on where. And the more those get violated, the harder it is to have confidence in what happens next. And I think Putin is invested in that in a big way. What'll be interesting is we mentioned sort of, you know, Russia, China, and the influence China has. You know, China does want rules. They want rules that favor them, but they're not into chaos necessarily. And so, you know, it gets to this question of just how far that Russia-Chinese alliance will go. It brings me to my next question I have for you, which is there have been a couple articles written recently, both in the military and strategic sense, but also in the political sense, about, you know, the sort of new alignment of autocracies that you see the Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians, and the North Koreans all butting up with each other. Thankfully, they haven't called it the Axis of Evil. I think that's been...
Just give it time. Any day now.
Somebody's going to come up with this great idea called the Axis of Evil. Go Google it for those young listeners in our group. But, you know, it does, I think, smack to people of sort of the Cold War redux. And I know people don't like that analogy, but you do see sort of, you know, the leader of the free world or the West increasingly being challenged by these autocracies that are trying to undermine democratic norms, predictability, and stability in the world because they recognize the balance of power on their own doesn't serve their interests. And that has big impacts for not just the geopolitical system, but for the nuclear system, right? If you're seeing Russia help North Korea on nuclear reactors or missiles, as you've seen Russia and China cooperate in these areas, if Iran decides that it really does want to go nuclear, to what extent is Russia or China, who have geostrategic interests in Iran, going to support that now that the rules of the road are gone? It's one of the reasons we talk baseball is because we just talk nukes all the time. It's really easy to get depressed. This is a very dark, difficult period for people focused on preventing nuclear risks from getting worse.
Yeah, I think that this rise of authoritarians and authoritarians potentially collaborating with each other is deeply concerning. I'm intentionally not calling it an alliance or alliances. And I think you're right to point to, you know, this has a whiff of the Cold War to it. But I also think there's some really important differences from the Cold War era. And I mean, first and foremost among them is I don't see as strong of some ideological underpinning to this collaboration as opposed to the Warsaw Pact or the Soviet bloc. If there's any ideological backing to a Russia, China, DPRK, Iran, you know, coalition forming, it's that they all hate the U.S. And I find that, you know, just having a shared hatred is not a particularly strong unifying function. It can be.
I have a lot of friends, Heather, and all we agree on is how much we hate the Red Sox. So you'd be surprised how visceral hatred could really.
I would bet that they are mostly Yankees fans, and therefore you are also bonded by your misplaced love of the Yankees. But that's fine.
It reminds me of my favorite New Yorker cartoon, which is two dogs at the bar saying it's not enough that dogs win, cats must lose.
Yeah, that sounds about right. But they're also two dogs who also share an identity. And I don't see a lot of shared underlying values or identity among the authoritarians that we're seeing come together. Also, you know, a couple months ago, we had a podcast about NATO's strength and NATO unity and NATO's nuclear mission, in addition to other things. And I remember we were comparing that to this growing coalition of authoritarians. And, you know, obviously I had to get in the Taylor Swift reference of what would your squad goals be? Would you really want to be in this authoritarian coalition, which is clearly opportunistic? Like, they will abandon each other at the drop of a hat if something better comes along. Whereas when we look at things like NATO, it's a much deeper historical alliance. Nonetheless, I do think this is one of the more worrying trends that we've been seeing in geopolitics in the past few years. So I don't know, John, what are your squad goals? Are you happy with our alliance system, or is that something that you think is a space to watch?
No. Well, I mean, am I happy with it? You bet. You know, we often get asked, or I often, you know me, I like to poke people in the nuclear establishment. And when people say, oh, China's building up this and Russia building up that, I just say, would you like to swap our nuclear arsenal for theirs? And they're like, no, of course not. And, you know, would we want to swap the NATO alliance or the East Asia allies for, you know, what you call it, coalition, or the collection of autocrats?
I haven't found the right term yet.
It's the alliteration's important.
You know, I need to find some. Just rolls off the tongue better than, like, you know, coalition of the
cronies, the coalition of cronies.
That's not bad. That's all right.
You know me, I don't know content, but, you know, turn of phrase is where I'm at.
You heard it here first, people. Coalition of the cronies.
So, I mean, it does get to this, you know, I think the one thing that unifies them other than hatred of the United States is these are all largely criminal regimes. And I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. I mean, they run through a system of criminal behavior, whether it is illegal oil sales or counterfeiting or arms running, and the leadership operates through that kind of criminal money laundering network. And so that is one thing where they work together and they learn from each other. It is also something that makes them vulnerable. But no, I think it's clear that the U.S. strength is magnified by our alliances, which are backed not just by military strength. I sound like a campaign slogan now, right? It's, you know, it's not the example of our power, it's the power of our example. But the fact that we are democratic, largely democratic, hopefully democratic regimes, working together to advance the well-being of our populations and to spread democracy. Some people think that's a bit evangelical, but I the world has benefited from that, and we have, as Americans, benefited from it. And that's, I think that's, again, not to get back into domestic politics, but that's what really frustrates me is, you know, people, I recognize that there's great inequity in the United States and there are people that benefit from the system more than others. But America is the richest, most prosperous, strongest country the world has ever known, in part because of our alliance system. And the idea that we would want to turn our backs on that, that we would basically say, you know what, the door's closed and you guys are on your own, is a self-inflicted wound. And I think people understand that. But there's also an emotional aspect here that's at work, that people are being manipulated in part because of foreign influence, but also just because we have always had this bug in the American system about isolationism that is another burden that our generation is having to focus on. There's an important aspect of that, though, which is that the U.S. system of alliances has also been an incredibly successful tool for preventing proliferation. And we hope to have them on soon. But there was a great event in Washington this week with Ulrike Kuhn from Hamburg, Center for Arms Control, a new book basically laying out the case for Germany and the debate going on in Germany about whether they should remain non-nuclear, whether they should push for a new European independent nuclear deterrent that would protect Europe, or whether they have to think about having an independent nuclear program. And I think you're going to see these arguments pop up the longer the debate in the United States continues about isolationism, is whether other countries in the U.S. orbit, like South Korea or Germany or Poland, need to think about independent nuclear programs. And that poses real challenges for American security and for global stability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this discussion about a Euro deterrent, I'm of multiple views on this one. You know, on the one hand, it's really hard to envision new nuclear actors, new nuclear possessors coming from Europe, you know, which has a much stronger legacy of nuclear activism and anti-nuclear activism, rather, I should say. I mean, in Germany in particular, just a few years ago, I thought Germany was more likely to join the nuclear ban treaty than to double its defense spending. And so seeing that, it's just really hard to envision that, you know, the one country that has left the nuclear non-proliferation treaty was North Korea. I don't think that Germany wants to be second, just a guess. I also don't think South Korea wants to be second. And so on the one hand, it's somewhat encouraging that those norms that you talked about, maybe those will hold, maybe the institutions will hold and still have this constraining power. At the same time, you know, I lived in Europe for a while, and one of the most powerful things that I really took away from it was Europeans have a completely different sense of the proximity of war. War is something so much more visceral. You know, I can talk about my grandfather's fighting in Europe and the Pacific. They talk about losing every boy in a village under the age of 25, you know, not boy, young men. And every train station in the UK has, you know, etched in marble the names of the kids who were lost. And I mean, this is mainly just, I was just in the UK. I mean, France, Germany, Poland, the Baltic states. And John, I know that's where, you know, your family comes from, the legacy of that as well. And so I always try to stress to a lot of Americans, like, Europeans just have a different sense of war and what war actually means. And the thing about this war in Ukraine, it is this kind of shattering that dream that, oh, well, that's not going to happen to us again. We're never again going to have to etch those names in marble or lose half of a village. And so I don't think that our allies should pursue nuclear weapons. On the other hand, that legacy is going to mean something different for them than it does for us.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think every country has its own national view and perspective and mindset. But that, I think, is part of what is changing day by day, right? I mean, if you look at the evolution in Germany, they have basically disappeared from the arms control landscape as they go through their own reevaluation about defense spending. It doesn't mean they've given up the ambition and even some of the pacifism that we helped instill in them over multiple generations. But it is changing. If you look at what's happened with President Macron, right, the videos that came out over the last couple of weeks, you could see the transformation in his tone talking to Putin before the start of the war and after the war, where France, dating back to the 1700s, has seen itself as a bridge to Russia, and that is broken, right? I mean, sorry to make broken bridge analogies this week because it's a horrible tragedy in Baltimore. But
have you seen Napoleon?
I haven't. Although I think it's on Netflix now, which shows you how quickly, you know, I'm more of a Nolan fan than a Ridley Scott fan. So, Oppenheimer, obvious reasons. But yeah, I think those are things. For example, you said you lived in Europe for a couple of years. Actually lived in the UK, because the UK is no longer Europe, right?
It was part of Europe when I was there. Well, actually, my time there was divided. Half the time I was there, we were part of Europe, and the other half we were not.
I want you to know, Heather, we do not blame you for Brexit. I know you did what you could to remain. That being said, it's an example of how quickly things are changing. And it's changing. I was just in Brussels a couple of weeks ago. You and I have traveled to Eastern Europe and the Baltics and Poland. There is great uncertainty, and they have invested for a generation now in NATO membership. They care about it deeply, and they do understand the impact of war. And I think we have to keep in mind that they watch the United States much more closely than we watch them. And that is just, it's going to have an effect. This is the part on We're All Gonna Die where we take a short break. Usually we ask our host, our guest to just sort of stand by, but Heather and I know the drill here. You by now should know the drill as well. We're going to go behind the very high, very strong, impenetrable paywall that you can get through for $7 a month. Not only will you get access to all of the free and paid content for this podcast, but the entire Deep State Radio network podcast systems. You can go to deepstateradio.com, subscribe for $7 a month, and get access to all of the work that David Rothkopf, Heather and I, and the other hosts here at DSR put together. We hope that you'll join us. For those that aren't members, we're going to have to say goodbye. And for those that are members or signing up rapidly now, hold on and we'll be with you in a minute.